you so much for doing this. I feel rather stupid having come across your work on the later part of my exploration of this entire idea spectrum that I've only recently sort of come across. And the reason why I feel stupid is because it is almost as if what you were saying is fundamental to understanding the rest of the picture. I think...
By the way, are we recording yet?
Yes, we are.
Because I don't see it on my end.
No, I just record on OBS.
Okay.
Oh, so it's a separate software that will record the whole thing, right? Because Zoom messes the quality up.
Sorry for
No. You're fine. That's fine. Yeah. It's almost like at least the exposure I've had to your ideas, both in text and in audio video. It's almost as if you are the one manning a very important node, and maybe the picture is more personal than it is palatable for the masses in that sense, because I often think we are no longer talking about ideologies. When we refer to ideologies, we are speaking of narratives, right? It's the ideological world has become sort of the narrativized world. It's two separate distinct narratives, not the precursor to narratives, which is ideology. Mm-hmm. And history, or the telling of history, is very important. We had this huge debate in the West while I was studying at Columbia about how postmodernist history has sort of reinterpreted what America and Canada stand for. This was the famous debate that Jordan Peterson sort of had, like all of that happening. And it made me realize how important narratives were for the formation of a cultural consciousness, let's just say, right?
Sure.
And throughout what I was listening to and reading, I kept wondering if what you were talking about should have been a book, and not just like as a fundamental way of delivering a complex set of ideas that are all interlinked. Have you considered, though, like writing a book about that?
Yes, sure. So, you know, part of the byproducts of all of these conversations, be it podcasts or the articles I've been writing, is to create a coherent set of ideas that can give people the tools they need to recognize false narratives and dismantle them on their own terms.
Hmm.
You know, I can't tell anyone what to think, and I shouldn't tell anyone what to think. No one should. But you can make people think and let them come to their own conclusions. And that's a huge failing of the Indian education system. It doesn't teach people how to think. It teaches people that X scholar, Y textbook is the holy book. Memorize it. This is your gospel. Spit it out in the exams, and your reward, you know, every step of the way, if you do well in school, you do well in university, the reward is you get to inch a little bit closer to being part of the elite. It doesn't give you any skills, it doesn't give you any critical thinking, and it prevents you from realizing the gross distortions around you.
So is your argument that we need to redo the education system, or is it that there are false narratives that exist in society, not just in education, that we sort of need to undo? Like, where is the thrust?
Both. They're a reflection of each other. Right. It's not just the education system that needs to be reformed or reconstructed. It's the entire conception of India as a state, in this post-independence period, where we have to constantly question and reevaluate whether the state institutions that we've created are working in the way that they were intended, or actually benefiting the citizens, actually reflecting their values and delivering on that, or whether it's the other way around and we've created another holy book that the people are unworthy of, and we need to constantly try to live up to the expectations of these wise men and this book, the Constitution. And it reminds me of what the East German poet said, Bertolt Brecht, who is in the syllabus in Delhi University, if you study English literature. He said that if the institutions have such a problem with the public, maybe they can dissolve the public and elect a new one, because it's so difficult for the public to get their voice heard.
That's so interesting. And so is it not the same? Because here is what I would think when I'd not seen the rest of the world. I'd be like, okay, we've got problems. For instance, the UK or the United States, they don't really have all that, a lot of problems, right? I go there and I realize that the sentiment, no matter how big or how different the problem might be, is pretty much the same. They're as irritated as I am with, say, or as frustrated as I am with my institutions as they are with their institutions, right?
Sure.
How is our situation so unique in comparison to, say, the rest of the world?
So our situation is unique because, unlike the UK, unlike France, unlike the US or Canada or Australia or New Zealand, which are developed countries who either were not colonized or, you know, are the descendants of colonizers themselves who have wiped out the indigenous populations or marginalized them, India is a former colony, in some ways still a semi-colony. Just like, you know, Latin America, just like much of Asia, much like all of Africa, except for two countries. And that means we're on a very different trajectory. That when decolonization happened, as it was then seen, the first wave, that the physical removal of the colonizer, that was not enough. You know, it's not enough to just arrange a power transfer between the colonial administrators and handpicked local bourgeois elite who have been trained to think, act, dress, talk, walk like the colonizer. And this happened in many countries. It happened in India, it happened in, you know, in African countries, it happened in the Caribbean, it happened in Latin America. But the first generation after independence were just locals who acted like the colonial elite.
Right.
Yes, exactly. Brown Englishmen or black Englishmen, as they were called in Africa. And, you know, they had studied at Oxford, they had studied all of this theory, but they had very little exposure to the kind of challenges that the poorest of the poor felt, or the lack of dignity and self-respect that had been engendered by generations and generations of colonial trauma. That people were impoverished, they were demoralized, they were degraded. And a huge challenge for any post-colonial country is to uplift them from that state, give them back their dignity, give them back their self-respect, give them back some element of economic self-reliance and material prosperity that had been robbed off them. And if we look at the Indian state today, since 1947, or even, let's say, from 1950, so 70 years ago when the Constitution came into being, have we delivered on that? And the answer is, unfortunately, no. On many of these parameters, we've done extremely badly. We have not really taken seriously the challenges of nation building or of giving people dignity or uplifting the poor in the way that other countries did. And then you look at countries in Eastern Europe, which were devastated after World War II. They had no money. Their cities had been destroyed. A quarter of the male population died in the war. And then for 40 years, they were still, you know, semi-colonial. You know, they were part of the Eastern Bloc, and you know, basically they did what Moscow told them. That did not prevent them from creating housing for everyone, giving everyone water, giving everyone electricity, giving everyone dignity. So why couldn't we do the same?
So, Ruchir, I'm with you on the frustration, right? Like, it's a very, like, I don't know how my existence goes down in history books. And by mine, I don't mean mine personally, but like this socioeconomic bracket, this cultural cross-section that I'm a part of. But it gives me a very unique window into the frustration myself. Like, I see it, I almost cannot wait for everybody to be not dying of starvation, for instance, or not being malnutritioned or all of that as well. Like, but is it not fair to say that, or is this not conventional to hear, that we are on the path of that happening? Why would I, because the solution you propose is rather a more radical one. Right now, somebody could come tell me, Prakhar, listen, this is, we've been only 70 years into independence. Chill the hell out, man. 50 years down the line, we'll have what you're looking for, right? Don't try to run a new experiment that will destroy all of what we've received up. And, you know, because the idea that you bring forth, that the reason why we're still here is because of this falsely constructed narrative that has not allowed the true transfer of power to the natives, where the natives don't represent themselves, that it's a colonial representation of a native population. And that mismatch is sort of keeping people where it's at. So whatever the solution might be from there is rather more radical. Right? Am I correct in understanding that? So
yes, exactly.
Is it not fair to say that we might be on the path that countries like Croatia, or for that matter, Slovakia, or other smaller countries that they sort of sort themselves out around richness, around wealth. They have Germany on one side and Austria on one side and Russia on one side. Is it not fair to say that we are on the journey?
Yes, but on a very slow mm-hmm. version of it, on a very chaotic and bendy road. And if we look beyond Eastern Europe, we can look at China, mm-hmm. we can look at Vietnam, mm-hmm. We can look at even, you know, countries in Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, also have large populations. They've also had, you know, huge past traumas of invasion, colonization. They were very distrustful of, you know, even globalization for a long time. But they're still delivering better outcomes for their people than we are.
Hmm.
And, you know, and it's not just these, you know, socialist-minded ones. You have countries like South Korea or Japan, which were, you know, quite avowedly anti-communist during the Cold War, and were essentially, you know, U.S. client states.
Right.
But they still had the political willpower to recover from colonization, from the war, from mm. poverty, from degradation, from lack of self-respect and dignity.
Mm.
So when these things are absent in India after 70 years, it's not because of any failing in the people. It's because of a failing in the system.
Mm.
It's because of a lack of political will. Mm. If you had political will, you can do this. You know, it's been proven, there's many paths. And at the end of the day, this is where we need to learn from Deng Xiaoping in China, who, you know, came to power in the 80s after, you know, the disastrous governance of Mao, you know, twice, who tried to jump, you know, a peasant society from feudalism to communism, you know, with the Great Leap Forward, then with the Cultural Revolution. And he reassessed the system and said that, well, he had two very famous sayings. One was, seek the truth from facts.
Hmm.
So, you know, learn to think, learn to analyze, find, you know, the truth and, you know, from facts, from, you know, undeniable facts, and learn from it. And the second was, it doesn't matter if it's a white cat or a black cat, as long as it catches mice, it's a good cat. And so what that means is, you know, it doesn't matter what the tool is that you're using, who it originally belonged to, what the label around it is. What matters is, does it bring you closer to your goal? If it does, it's a good tool, and tools belong to whoever wields them.
Right.
And that's something that's missing in India, that we're married to, you know, a 1940s, 1950s conception of the country, which has become outdated, which doesn't reflect the aspirations of the masses, and is leading to a lot of social, political, and economic friction.
Well, I agree. We can no longer sort of play poverty politics if we want to make a country rich. That by itself is the beginning of a contradiction that just is implosive, right? I'm with you on that. But when you say it's not the people, it's the system, I wonder if it's the circumstance. Like, if it's the fact that we are... The range of diversity is at least three-dimensional in India, which is quite unlike almost any other part of the world. Probably the closest that we come to is Europe, and Europe's pretty centralized in that sense too, where they sort of kind of have overlaps ever long. We have just the strangest kind of linguistic, cultural, blah, 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 blah. You know how they gloss over that with unity and diversity in the official narrative. So could it not be that the political will cannot exist because we are so inherently different from each other? Is that a genuine stumbling block, or is that an exploited fissure in the system? What do you think?
It's not a stumbling block at all. There are many countries that have diverse geographies, diverse populations, they have linguistic diversity, they have a federal structure, and the reason they're divided into conveniently administrable states is to overcome this challenge.
Right.
You know, it would have been very easy to create a unitary state in India, like in China, where the central government exists, there's no states, and then there's districts, and the central government tells the districts what to do, they implement it. But we didn't, you know, we have a decentralized federal system, so does Russia, so does the US, so does Australia, so does Canada. And you know, in these countries that span vast geographies, that have a lot of diversity, that's why, you know, you seek to filter down administrations into smaller units where you can achieve the same sorts of results that, you know, a country like you said, Croatia or Germany, can do in Europe.
Right.
Or for that matter, Vietnam.
Right. So, and the other part of what you had said was something about political will, right? The fact that political will, political intent, sort of where the human element of the tool bearer comes in, which is what is the intent of what you're doing. And intent's a tricky space, right? Like, it's one thing to attribute intent. It's absolutely another to investigate it. Like, you can barely ever come to what the intent might be. You could probably have a circumstantial case. But, you know, it's 2014 was the representation of some kind of a change in that sense. We were all hoping kind of... as citizens, we were kind of hoping that this man is going to bring that sort of a change, that sort of an intent, that sort of a vision for the next part of India's journey. We had barely escaped economic depression 25 years ago, or almost economic ruin at some point, and now we were finally standing on our feet. The world was beginning to say, hey, India, you are an entity, and we needed a new sort of a guy. Is, like, would you say, what is this 1940s approach that is still present in the present political will, or was sort of being tested in the 2014 election? This like you said, the 1940s version of the narrative that no longer fits the aspiration of our nation now. What is that? Like, what is this residue that we're carrying?
So this is, you know, what some media personalities and self-appointed intellectuals call the idea of India. That's, you know, it's essentially a form of nostalgia for, you know, this imagined glorious past of single party rule, where a party and leader and family who they claim are socialist and they claim are liberal were in power and were always doing good things for everyone. The reality check is they were not socialist, they were not liberal, they were a self-serving elite. And that's, you know, been clear for to anyone who has looked at the history of post-independence India, that, you know, if this party, this ideology, this worldview, this narrative had unfettered power for decades and decades to remold the country in whatever shape it wanted, it had a Lok Sabha majority, it had a Rajya Sabha majority, it packed the courts with, you know, its own self-replicating elite, you know, it chose the IAS, IPS, IRS officers, you know, all from that same stratum of society. They had this big vision, this idea of India. Great, they brought it to life. What did they bring to life? Do we have liberal values in India? Do we have freedom of expression? Do we have freedom of media? No, they're severely curtailed. And it's because of that party. Do we have socialism in India? Do we have a welfare net? Do we have housing for all? Do we have people getting water, electricity, food? No. There's a lot of disconnect there. And it's only in the last 6 years that there's been a push to, you know, to bridge that gap. So if over these decades, you know, you gave them a fair run to create the India of their dreams and they delivered this, of course, it will lead to frustration. And of course, in 2014, there was you know, this moment where things snapped and people started to see through the narratives that there had been a very consistent media narrative about certain parties being, you know, against the idea of India, or, you know, they were smeared with, oh, they're Hindu nationalist this, or they're Hindutva that, they're right-wing authoritarian fascist. And people saw through that and voted for them anyway. Now, over these 6 years, many of those people have been disappointed by the lack of speed or intent shown by this new new government. And that is, you know, it comes from two places. One is a misunderstanding of the party. So the BJP as a party, although it has been called right wing, although it has been called a Hindu nationalist party, doesn't claim to be itself. And it's not the founding ideology behind it, and it's not, you know, the primary motivation behind the
party. Or what they're doing. Like,
yeah, or what they're doing. And that's right. Reflected in their policy.
Right.
You know, it's just that the country is so starved of any party that stands for like equal rights for equal citizens as opposed to special rights for certain communities, that, you know, a party that is quite moderate in this becomes the only choice for, you know, pro-Hindu voters.
Right.
So you can say that the BJP is not openly antagonistic to Hindus.
Right.
But it's also not, you know, seeking to revive, you know, the
former
Hindu
glory.
Mahasabha.
Oh, right.
Or, yeah, you know, or that vision for the country. So that's one thing. The other is that it also arose, you know, the modern BJP was founded only in 1980, and it arose from the Janata Party experiment. That's why it's called the Bharatiya Janata Party. It was a successor party to the 3 years that we saw between 1977 and 1980, so after the emergency, when the Janata Party coalition, which was a coalition of anti-Congress parties, so it included the old Congress. So remember, Indira Gandhi in the 60s split the Congress, and her Congress was the new Congress, later called the Congress R, requisition, and Congress I for Indira. Mm-hmm. And the traditional Congress was seen as a bit more to the right, a bit more pro-American, or, you know, a bit more suspicious of Soviet aid. And they teamed up with various socialist parties. There was the Praja Socialist Party, there was George Fernandez's Samyukt Socialist Party, there was the Jan Sangh, which was the predecessor to the BJP in many ways, at least in terms of the leadership. That's where you had people like Deen Dayal Upadhyay or Atal Bihari Vajpayee. They came together and created what was essentially a center-left coalition to oppose the new Congress of Indira Gandhi, which was seen as authoritarian, autocratic, and conservative. But conservative in a very interesting way. Like, not that there's some sort of defined conservatism that, you know, applies universally. In this case, conservatism meaning they wanted to keep things the way they were, you know, in this post-independence power transfer that they had arranged.
Hmm.
And as a result, people opposing them, the Janata Party or Jayaprakash Narayan's Sampurna Kranti Andolan, Total Revolution Movement, or Morarji Desai's Navnirman Andolan, the Renaissance or Refoundation Movement in Gujarat, these were radical revolutionary attempts to complete the job of decolonization. And you see it in many countries. In many countries in Africa or in Latin America, after a few generations of the initial power transfer and the initial independence, people got frustrated that they were still living the same lives they did under new management.
Hmm.
And they wanted a decolonization of institutions, a decolonization of minds.
What are a few examples of that? And how did those turn out, those experiments?
So Sri Lanka is one.
Hmm.
Sri Lanka wrote a new constitution in 1978,
hmm.
where they ditched the British system of parliamentary democracy, and now they have a semi-presidential one.
Mm-hmm.
They also created a unitary state, so no federalism, and made a couple of interesting changes. So they made Sinhala and Tamil the official languages. English was demoted to a link language. And then there's Article 9, which says the state shall promote Buddha Dharma, so the Buddhist faith, and Buddhist Shashan, so Buddhist administration wherever possible, while also guaranteeing other religions, you know, equal rights as part of Article 14. Now, that's an example of, you know, people within a generation of initial independence. You know, they even renamed the country from Ceylon to Sri Lanka, taking command of their destiny. And since then, the constitution has been amended a few times, as, you know, any living document should. But ours has in India has been amended over 100 times, which shows that you know, it is increasingly unsuited and requires constant maintenance. And there was, you know, an attempt during the Janata Party experiment during 1977 to 1980, where they tried to undo the constitutional amendments that had been pushed through by Indira Gandhi during the emergency, like socialist and secular in the preamble. They tried to blacklist.
Hold up. I'm so sorry. Yeah. You're telling me secular and socialist were not part of the preamble up until the 70s?
No, until emergency. And in 1975, when the opposition was all arrested, so and parliament, you know, was essentially Congress in both houses, and democracy was suspended, they were pushed through in dubious legal circumstances.
What an interesting fact, huh?
And no party has been able to undo this, even though, you know, the Janata Party came to power promising they would undo the illegal acts, illegal amendments done during emergency. The institutions are designed in such a way that they couldn't, because there has never been a non-Congress majority in the Rajya Sabha. So the institutions are designed to be conservative and keep us, you know,
in that loop,
in the default operating system, as Rahul Gandhi calls it. So he says that the Congress is the default operating system. So, you know, now if you have a really shitty operating system, if you're stuck on Windows 95,
oh my God,
then the solution isn't to patch it. The solution is to
revamp,
you know, wipe your disk. Yeah. Yeah, you know, format the hard drive and install something.
Maybe buy a new computer altogether. Like that, within, exactly, within the scope of that analogy, I think that's what you need to do. But I see. It's so, you know, what was also very interesting to me when we were talking on the phone, I was quite surprised by it. And I know this is not what you were trying to say, and I might butcher sort of what we were talking about. But the impression that rubbed off of me to some extent was that it is not just that the institutions were designed that way, but it is that education, and from before education, narratives were designed that way, that they were kept in a specific way for a trade-off between harmony and truth, where, you know, we'll discard truth to earn extra harmony. And it's sort of like I've had the marginal utility full of that exchange. Like, give me the truth, no more of that harmony bullshit, you know. And this is sort of what those false narratives are also, that I've heard you talk about and write about, is that they've been repeated over and over as if the subaltern and the native is this distressed, confused individual that needs to be rescued by this colonial, this Tarzan representation of a white woman saving the, you know, like that kind of a thing. I may have butchered that, but is that accurate?
No, absolutely. I think, and it's clear with it, if you look at the archives as well, that upon independence, there was a huge trauma added to colonial trauma, and that was the trauma of partition. You know,
right.
And not just partition, the events leading up to partition. There was the Mopla Rebellion, there was Direct Action Day, there was the Noakhali riots in East Bengal, and then there was the partition, which, you know, led to a massive upheaval, led to mass migrations, it led to mass killings, to sexual violence. And, you know, this was something that needed, you know, this was a wound that needed to be healed. There needed to be truth, there needed to be reconciliation. But the post-independent state took a very different view, because they didn't have to experience that. They were, you know, an insulated elite who, you know, watched these things happen. And they saw, you know, the best solution as, oh, you know, we should never speak about this again. We should bury this trauma. And, you know, we've seen that it's very easy to deploy violence against the state. We don't have the capacity to prevent another Direct Action Day. We don't have the capacity to prevent another partition either. So what we have to do is create harmony. That's our preventative strategy.
That's the second best we can go for in that sense.
Yes,
right?
That, you know, now, you know, there's, you know, a community whose leadership has shown that they can successfully challenge the authority of the state through, you know, massive disproportionate violence. What do we do with them? We bribe them. bribe them, win over their loyalty, you know, bend over backwards, make sure that, you know, nobody steps on that landmine, because we can't guarantee, you know, what will happen if someone does that. That was one approach. And the other, and this is borne out if you go into the archives and look at the correspondence going through the Ministry of Education and the Prime Minister's Office, or the Zakir Hussain Commission in the 40s and 50s, and then in the 60s when Nurul Hasan became the Education Minister, that there was a directive saying that it's very important to create an atmosphere of harmony within the country by, you know, not highlighting atrocities done by the sultanates or by the Mughal Empire towards native religions, towards the common people, and rather feed them the narrative that, oh, you know, everyone lived in great peace and harmony until the British came, and then they used divide and conquer to separate us. And look, you know, now because we lost that secularism, because we lost that inclusiveness, partition was our punishment. So, you know, we have to do penance now. We have to be more sensitive. We have to be more accommodating. So, you know, they first caused partition through their own cowardice by not standing up to Jinnah, by not standing up to the British, and then transferred and projected this cowardice onto the people, saying, oh, you deserve this because, you know, you didn't, you weren't secular enough, you weren't accommodating enough, if only you had done that. So, you know, now, instead of seeing that British India was partitioned into two, it was partitioned into a Muslim homeland and into a Hindu, Buddhist, Jain, Sikh homeland, they saw it as, oh, secular India had two parts of it separated to make Pakistan, but we are obliged to, you know, continue on that path, which was a very bizarre choice. And when you also look at the archives and the anecdotes of the partition negotiations, you see some very interesting patterns. So when Jinnah met the Cripps Commission, when he met Mountbatten, he wasn't under any delusions like this. He said, you know, that's complete nonsense. The two communities have always lived separately. Throughout history, they had separate villages, separate neighborhoods, separate customs, separate
everything.
And the foundational principle of Pakistan is the two-nation theory. By accepting partition, we have validated the two-nation theory. So, you know, by default, even if, you know, they haven't officially made it so, India was Hindu Rashtra. It was the Hindu homeland and was created as such. That's something that, you know, was very inconvenient and was buried by the Congress administration. And it's also something that, you know, if you look at what the RSS says today, you know, they're not even very ambitious about this. They don't have big plans to turn India into a Hindu Rashtra. They say India already is a Hindu Rashtra. So, you know, they're like, oh, maybe we'll just make it official. So, and during the same negotiations, the Congress was represented by Maulana Azad, who, you know, gave forth that, oh, yes, you know, we should have a united India, but give lots of power to the states so that, you know, each state can have enough autonomy to keep us together, and a common foreign policy, common army, you know, basically the modern Indian federal state.
Right.
And the third party in the negotiations was the Hindu Mahasabha, who are smeared today as, oh, you know, these right-wing Hindutva fascists, who said they wanted to avoid partition at all costs and were willing in Akhand Bharat, in undivided India, to provide all forms of minority rights to all minorities. So their vision is also the same as today's secular India. All they opposed was separate electorates, right, where 33. So the other alternative to partition was 33% of the population that was Muslim would get an equal number of seats to 67% of the population that were of Dharmic faiths, which was unacceptable in the negotiations to them. But, you know, there was always this approach of soft secularism.
Right. You know, again, it's And I told you my intent already, so I don't have to sort of pussyfoot around the question. What you have to tell me, and only consider my shoes, what you have to tell me is has a lot of intent attribution, right? Like, this is what so-and-so wanted at that point. They projected so-and-so and whatnot. And I'm willing to believe that. Like, I have an open mind to that. But where do I investigate? What do I look at? How do I figure it out? And how have you figured it out? Like, what are the clear signals that this is exactly how it was, as opposed to, you know, the passive approach of what I've always been taught and what will probably be taught for the next two generations? Like, how do I take that great leap forward?
Nice use of great leap forward. So what's important to look at is the motivations and incentive structures behind any decision making.
Right.
At the end of the day, all, you know, humans are affected by motivation and incentive.
Hmm.
And when you look at the mentalities behind the new elite that came to power after independence, they did see themselves as cut off from the rest of society. They saw themselves as this enlightened elite whose responsibility it was. And I'm sure it came from, you know, good intentions.
Right.
They weren't malicious in, you know, in an outright way. It's not that they hated the Indian public. They just felt that, oh, these poor, helpless, you know, people, they're blinded by superstition. They're poor because they're, you know, so religious and backwards. And, you know, I, as an enlightened, westernized person, you know, if I could teach them to be more like me, if we could make them all, you know, Europeans, then one day we'll be treated as equals. You know, maybe
right.
We'll be, you know, yes, you know. And this was also a part of what's called neocolonialism. So, you know, when traditional colonialism ended, then it doesn't mean that we stopped being exploited. We were just exploited in hidden ways.
Right.
And one of those ways is how Western NGOs and Western governments, you know, come in with this tired old spiel, which is, oh, if only you acted more like us, one day you could be rich like us. And you know, people in the 50s and 60s really believed that.
Right.
They thought, oh, you know, Europe or, you know, North America, they're rich because they deserved it, because, you know, their culture and society, you know, was so scientific, that it was just so, you know, open and tolerant. And if we just, you know, copy all of their, you know, constitutional values and impose them on our country, then we can be like them.
Right.
But that's not true. Mm-hmm. These countries got rich, you know, by colonialism, by protectionism, through internecine wars, through nationalism, ethno-linguistic nationalism. And that's, you know, to look at them after they've gone through all that and say, oh, they're rich because they're so Christian, or because they're so enlightened, because they threw away superstition, that's just falling for their trap. That's what they say to trick you, so that, you know, you continue to buy their expertise, to buy their products, to listen to them and do what you're told, like a good little third world country.
Right. You know, what is also very interesting about you, I was reading you a lot and listening to you a lot. The language that you use, and it might be that when you say, I use Marxist tools to dismantle Marxist narratives, is traditionally like left-wing. It's not what people would traditionally identify as a right-wing language. When you say stuff like neocolonialism being a problem, ethnolink, that is the language of American academia to some degree in my head, because like that's where I've spotted that language being used. Like, it's nowhere else, but the position you take is very interesting. Using that language. And I wonder how much of that has got to do with your own... I mean, it invariably does, right? I was very bought into the idea of justice. It's a very prima facie appealing idea. When you're 18, you're like, yeah, I want things to be just, right? Mm-hmm. And you go down that road and there is disillusionment, to which then you adjust and you correct. And it sort of is that your personal journey sort of feeds your intellectual journey, sort of feeds your personal journey and so on. And I wonder, because you'd mentioned, I think on Kushal's, that or the talk that you'd been students of some of this elite, like you studied under Romila Thapar, I think, at DU. Is that a correct?
No, no. Romila Thapar is at JNU, and
JNU.
She's an emeritus. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I studied at JNU.
Right.
And oh, sorry, sorry. I studied at DU. So sorry,
where is it that you went to school? At DU? What college?
Hansraj College.
Hansraj.
Yes, so North Campus.
And you studied history?
Yes, so BA History Honors. And the entire syllabus was designed by, you know, our eminent historians, by Romla Thapar, by D.N. Jha, R.S. Sharma, Irfan Habib. It was full of their readings. And it was designed from a, you know, purist Marxist perspective. You know, in your first year, you studied modes of productions and social formations, which was about the shifts in history from, you know, the slavery mode of production to the feudal mode of production to the capitalist mode of production to the communist mode of production, and, you know, how you have a material foundation for all history, and that history is not the story of individual kings and queens or, you know, revolutionaries, but rather about larger historical processes which are socioeconomic in nature. That there's a material foundation behind everything, how people create value, how people sustain themselves, and on top of that, everything else is a superstructure built on that foundation. So right. What we consider law, religion, culture, these are all reflections of the incentive structure created by, you know, how you actually make a living, whether you're living under slavery, whether you're living under feudalism, whether you're living under capitalism.
What do you think about that idea now? Because
I think it's fantastic. I think it's a, you know, very useful set of tools to analyze history. And, you know, the thing is, labels aren't really useful when it comes to tools. You know, Marxism as a pure, Marxism as a pure set of tools, you know, without Leninism, without Maoism, without the revolutionary aspects that came later. If you just look at Marx, it's about giving a set of tools to understand history, society, and the economy. And those tools don't belong exclusively to people who call themselves Marxists, and they definitely don't belong to the parties that claim to be Marxists.
Hmm.
Tools belong to whoever wields them.
Right.
Weapons belong to whoever wields them.
Hmm.
If you can use tools effectively, if you can use languages effectively to achieve your goals, to make your point, then it's like what Deng Xiaoping said, right. White cat, black cat,
same
it's
thing.
Catching mice, it's a good cat.
Hmm.
So, you know, we shouldn't limit ourselves by, you know, the labels around certain tools or philosophies, but embrace what brings you closer to your goal and discard what puts obstacles in it.
You know, the problem with that, you're absolutely right. And I think it takes more maturity than a 24-year-old is expected to have to realize that. But what comes packaged with these tools, at least initially, is also a worldview. It's not just ideas. It's not just the skeleton or the architecture or the framework of ideas. It's also the ends of those ideas. And so you consume them wholesome. And maybe later, when you consume something else, you have to decide what you want to keep in your stomach still. I'm sorry, the analogy is going way off. But like, it's sort of kind of like that, right?
Yes.
And so, I may be wrong, but you also referred to the fact that you were bought into this worldview. Apart from just the tools, you were bought into the worldview of Marxism as well.
Yes,
right?
Sure. You know, the entire Indian education system, especially
right.
if you study humanities, is designed, you know, to mold you in certain phases.
Mm-hmm.
So you go to school, school teachers, school textbooks tell you that, oh, everything you learned from your parents and your grandparents about history, you know, that's rubbish. You know, this is the official history according to the NCRT. Akbar was this great king, you know, so secular, you know, oh, he, you know, cared so much. And, oh, Khilji, you know, was famous for his tax reform, you know, not for storming the South. What slavery? No slavery. You know, everything was,
right.
you know, great. And the British came and, you know, used divide and rule on us. Then you go to university, study history or sociology or English literature, or political science. And then they tell you, oh, no, everything you learned in school was also rubbish. You know, the real history was written by, you know, these doyens of academia. And, you know, it says that, you know, and they do take edgy positions, which are very attractive to, you know, someone youngsters coming into university. And then you tell them, you know, you break them down that, oh, you know, everything you learned in school was a lie. In fact, Gandhi was, you know, not the hero of independence. Mm. You know, he was a bourgeois, you know, traitor who, you know, betrayed the common people. And that, you know, you had... various schools of historiography. So they tell you that, oh, when you look at Indian history, it comes in various phases. Initially, there were the British historians who took an Orientalist perspective. They're like, oh, look at these wacky Easterners. You know, they live under tyranny. You know, their past is all darkness. You know, looking at them like, you know, animals in a zoo. And some of them were well-intentioned. Some of them were writing this for the East India Company. Some of them were writing it for the church. Basically, they were, you know, writing to understand better the subcontinent and how better to build upon the existing tools of administration and governance so that they could effectively rule their new colony. Then in the late 1800s, you know, and the first half of the 20th century, this was repelled by the nationalist school of historians.
Hmm.
And they're the ones who, you know, went in and looked at primary sources and said, no, you know, ancient India was not a period of Oriental despotism where, you know, people lived in, you know, poverty and sadness while this evil tyrant ruled upon them. We had very sophisticated modes of governance. We had the Mahajanpads, which were noble republics of the time in ancient times. We had empires. We had naval achievements, merchant achievements. We had military achievements. And it helped create a sense of identity, a sense of self-respect that, you know, we weren't just a country of barbarians who were civilized with each coming wave of invaders and colonizers, because that's essentially what you know, helped the British you know, justify their rule, that, oh, you know, you're no strangers to being invaded and colonized, you know, and we're pretty benevolent compared to the others. And then, so during this phase, these nationalist historians, you had people like Romesh Chandra Majumdar, you had people like K.A. Neelakant Shastri. They you know, created the foundation for the national movement. And nationalism was not seen as a dirty word then as it is in some circles now. And in fact, it shouldn't be considered a dirty word in any post-colonial society.
Right.
There's a difference between the nationalism of the colonizer. So nationalism in France or Germany or in the US, you know, yes, it has terrible past connotations because it's associated with, you know,
expansionism.
Yeah, an expansionist, genocidal tendency, a very exclusionary one, with war, with suffering. Whereas nationalism in a colony is about forcing the world to recognize your humanity, that, you know, we are equal humans, you know, to anyone else, and we deserve the right to have our own nation. That we're not, you know, subhumans, that we're not second-class people who, you know, are so stupid that they need to be, you know, looked after. And this was, you know, still mainstream. Like, even after the First World War, the League of Nations, which was the first attempt at the United Nations, they had something called the mandate system. The mandate system said that there are certain colonies that used to belong to Germany, or certain territories in the Middle East that used to belong to the Ottoman Empire, and they're not ready for their own state. They're not, you know, capable of self-governance. So very benevolently, we're going to put France and the UK in charge of them. So, you know, Lebanon was given to France. Iraq was given to the UK. They partitioned it, you know, in a way that, you know, still causes issues.
Very interesting.
And so, you know, the nationalism of, you know, a colony is against that, that, you know, it doesn't matter what you think of us. You know, we are, you know, a nation, we have a common identity, and we deserve to govern ourselves on our own terms, without your interference, without your judgment, without your supervision. And that applies even today. And these countries are still trying to, you know, sell us this narrative in, you know, more sophisticated ways with their NGOs and with their media. But it still comes down to that.
You also, I'm assuming, had some sort of a disillusionment with, say, the conventional, or what is taught to me in school, what is taught to the likes of me in school. Because you said you grew up understanding that. In college, it was sort of reified and revised in its own way, sort of more radicalized, if I may. But then you had, let's just say, an inflection point. What was that like?
Well, so when you know, leave the toxic environment of the Indian elite, humanities, academia, or you know, its children, you know, the IAS and
all
and,
that, yes,
you know, media in Delhi, and experience perspectives from outside that circle. When you look at how, you know, other countries after independence developed, how they created their own indigenous ideologies, their own forms of statecraft. So in Africa, you had so many, you know, in Ghana, you had Kwame Nkrumah, you had in Tanzania, Julius Nyerere, you had Jomo Kenyatta in Kenya. They were talking about African socialism. They were talking about Ujamaa. There was Kenneth Kaunda in Zambia. So Ujamaa was about village democracy from the bottom up instead of a top-down constitution. And then, you know, you look at your own country and you say, you know, how come we only have such limited exposure to any of our own post-independence indigenous ideologies? It's just that, oh, you know, you have these westernized liberals and you have these westernized communists, and then you have these you know, Hindu nationalists. But that ignores a lot of the very exciting ideas that came up in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s especially, as people got more and more frustrated with post-independence India. There's a great film called India at 20. It was made by the Films Division of the Government of India, you know, and tracked people who were born in and around 15th August 1947, 20 years later, in 1967, and interviewed these young people. And it's a fascinating one. It's available on YouTube. I would highly recommend you check it out. And there were people saying that, oh, what has independence meant to me after 20 years? What did freedom mean? Freedom to starve, freedom to go naked. You know, that I see people living, you know, in poverty. I see, you know, government apathy. The, you know, the rich have enriched themselves. They're using the, you know, same sadistic tools that the British did, the same police. And you even had, you know, the CPI, after upon independence, their great slogan was, "This independence is fake." So they had a campaign called "Ye Azadi Jhooti Hai," and they argued that Gandhi betrayed the nation through partition. He betrayed the working class. Nehru was a brown Englishman who was creating a fascist police state. And that the country was manned by a bureaucracy who were, you know, Englishmen and everything except skin color.
Which is sort of kind of what your idea is too, right?
Yeah, which is in fact what many voters believe even today.
For sure.
70 years later. The CPI may have given up on this narrative, but all that meant is that this narrative has been inherited by the BJP. And you even see a lot of overlap in and jumping between the two parties, that there's many people, like millions of people, who in the last 10 years have switched from being CPM voters, CPI voters, left front voters, to BJP voters, or at least sympathizers. You see it in Bengal. There's an almost direct vote transfer, that 8 out of 10 people who voted for the left front 10 years ago voted for the BJP at last year's election. 2 days ago, there was an event in West Bengal, which was the induction of CPM cadre. So, you know, these you know, members of the party who had been trained, you know, in party ideology, who used to go, you know, door to door, house to house, used to enforce party loyalty and rule, they joined the BJP, mm-hmm. you know, and this is, it's quite an easy shift. You know, you think that they're the two opposite ends of the spectrum, but they believe the same things. So the mm-hmm. Congress is discredited, and both of these parties essentially got their appeal from being radical revolutionary forces that want to end the sick, decayed, dysfunctional system of the Congress that it's trying to conserve. And as soon as the left front got into bed with the Congress, their voters started abandoning them. Right. They didn't vote for the left front because they love Marx or they love Mao or they love Lenin. They voted for them to, you know, stick a finger in the eye of the Congress.
Right.
And if you give up on that in order to save secularism, voters don't care about that. Voters care about you delivering government services to them. They care about seeing themselves reflected in state institutions.
Hmm.
And they will vote for whoever delivers them that.
Hmm. Hmm. All right. I have one last question, after which I'm happy to excuse you. This has been very, very dense in that sense. I'd mentioned to you how, like, my immediate fascination with you, even before any of, like, our conversations had happened, any of the recommendations from people had happened, any of that had happened, even probably before I'd spoken to Kushal, was from your Twitter bio. And
oh, yes.
And I don't think I did. Maybe I did. I'm not sure. The other day when we were speaking on the phone, the reason why that is, I mean, you know, anybody, not anybody might not be the right place to start, but for sure there is approximate example in your head of an individual. It might be you, it might be somebody else who grows up believing that they're capable, resourced, conditioned, responsible enough to do something for the people that are around them, the nation at large and so on. And when they come to do that, they especially in a country like India, you realize over and over what a mess the whole thing is. And when you realize what a mess the whole thing is, a very naive attempt is to think, I need to do something novel. And, you know, you might come up with those novelties once in a while as well. Oh, this is an idea I have. This is an idea. I'm humble enough to be like, I'm stupid. But I still get those ideas. And very often I've tried to see as to if that idea has been tried before. Right? And I have not, or maybe I'm just not literate enough on that front, but the recent idea that I've been playing with, probably a more free market, wealth-focused model of the economy, probably a more free speech and truth model of the society, I've never found somebody stand up for it. It doesn't seem like the BJP is standing up for it. It doesn't seem like the Congress ever stood for it either. It seems like we are betrayed on sort of both ends. The communists, I don't expect a lot from at all anyway. So I, like, when I read about Jayaprakash, whom I'd heard from my father several times, he kept me very updated on this version of history. I think partly because he studied at a school that was run by Ashoka. He was so poor growing up that that is all he could afford. He learned that version of history. He passed it on to me. So privileged me enough to have my eyes open on both ends. It wasn't like I was ever, you know. He'd mentioned Jayaprakash to me. And I wonder if that is the man I'm looking for. Was he the kind of man who was leading some sort of a truth and wealth model over harmony and distribution model of the country?
In a way, yes, because you know what he stood for was, you know, so Sampurna Kranti, meaning total revolution, which was a social, cultural, political, moral, spiritual regeneration of the country after 25 years of what was seen as a failed experiment in Nehruvian socialism, Nehruvian secularism, Nehruvian, you know, philosophy. And what's, you know, so today, you know, you're very right in saying there's no party that believes in free markets or free speech. You know, all of them will say these are, you know, Western ideas that will not fit in India. In fact, I would say there's only 5,000 people in all of India who understand what, you know, pure free speech is and what pure free markets are. 4,000 of them won't vote anyway. Mm-hmm. So there's 1,000 who are active about it, you know, wherever possible. 1,000 people won't win you a single seat in any constituency. So it's a negligible vote bank. It's not some, you know, influence group that will have any power on it, unfortunately. Now, when we look at Jayaprakash, oh, before I mention Jayaprakash, you know, you touched on something very interesting about creating, you know, a free market, about creating freedom of speech and, you know, privileging truth over, you know, convenience.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many, you know, let's say, neo-Marxists, you know, who have reinterpreted reclaimed Marxism from, you know, Leninism or Maoism or all of these politicized versions of it and gone back to the essential tools.
Hmm.
And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, they talk about how history is a series of processes, you know, shifting from feudalism to capitalism, from capitalism to socialism. One of them is Slavoj Žižek. Mm-hmm. From Slovenia.
Yep.
So, yeah, he, you know, you would be familiar with him because he debated Jordan Peterson.
Oh, I've loved his recently. Work for forever because yeah. I've never understood it.
Well, so if I may, I could recommend a great video of his. He gave a speech at the Royal Society about 10 or 11 years ago. It's called First as Tragedy, Then as Farce.
Yep.
Yes. And in that, you know, he talks about how the center left, or, you know, soft socialists, social democrats, or liberals, you know, who, you know, he considers center right, you know, liberals as a center right ideology, what they do is actually more harmful in the long run. That it's best to show people how brutal the system is. You know, if feudalism is brutal and cruel, people need to experience that brutality and cruelty so that they, you know, can break it, so that they can break those bonds.
Hmm.
If capitalism is unfair, then don't try to make it a little bit more tolerable by putting a human face on it and adding, you know, some vague human rights here and some social justice there. All that does is distract people
right.
from the misery that they're in.
Right.
So he says that it's, you know, and then you add some charity here and there, and that just degrades and demoralizes people.
He has that great Starbucks example. I don't know if you're familiar
exactly.
with that. Right? It's bloody hilarious.
Yes. And,
yeah.
and you, exactly. And, you know, you feel good, you feel warm inside, but you leave those people in the same conditions that made them poor in the first place.
Right.
So, in fact, you know, in a country like India, which is, you know, we're not even capitalist yet. You know, we're still a feudal, semi-feudal society and polity,
right.
And, you know, a feudal electoral system as well, where we're just voting for our, you know,
caste, right, or
yeah.
something like that.
Yeah, you know, so an MP, you know, in a mature democracy, an MP's job is to represent the views of their constituents in parliament. Is that what happens in India?
No.
No, people see, oh, I'm electing the little Raja of my constituency, and, you know, if I vote for him, then, you know, maybe he'll pay attention to me and say, oh, you can have a road in your village.
Right.
And if I vote for my caste guy, then, you know, I'll be able to file an FIR at the police station without them beating me up for it.
Right.
You know, people are so desperate that this is what they vote for.
That's the incentive.
And this is what the MPs want. MPs want to feel like the kings and queens of their constituencies, even though they don't have any executive power.
Yeah.
An MP's job is to sit in parliament and vote.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing more, nothing less. Not to use the MP local development funds to reward their supporters.
For sure.
And not to fix the roads in your village.
Mm-hmm.
For that, you have the Zilla Parishad, you have, you know, the Panchayat, you have various forms of decentralized governance. We live in feudalism with elections. Now, the best way to end that is not to make it a little bit better and, you know, by adding some feel-good measures, but rather to accelerate the transition to capitalism so that people are given the tools that they can use to lift themselves out of poverty or to demand a state that reflects their, you know, that's a reflection of their values.
Right.
So, you know, and this goes back to even what Oscar Wilde said, you know, before socialism was, you know, taken up by, you know, Leninists and revolutionaries in the 20th century. Oscar Wilde, the Irish poet and playwright, he wrote a book called The Soul of Man Under Socialism, in which he said the worst slave owners were the ones who were kind to their slaves.
Who were what to the slaves?
Who were kind.
Oh, kind to the slaves.
So the worst slave owners are the ones who were kind to their slaves, because it prevented the horror of the system from being, you know, realized by those who suffered from it and being theorized by those who contemplated it. And, you know, that just delays the inevitable. That, you know, making an unfair system a little bit more tolerable.
Right. Only prolongs.
Is not, yeah, it prolongs the disease. It doesn't cure the disease.
Right.
It just makes people suffer longer.
Right.
And taking decisive action, and that can, you know, take various forms.
It's like drinking your hangover away. Right? Yes. It just prolongs it. It's just going to happen the next day, right? That might be a fit analogy.
Yes, it gives you temporary relief, but right. long-term agony.
Right.
Right. And, you know, sometimes painful measures are needed to overcome the disease.
For sure.
And so then if we go back to the second part of your question about Jayaprakash, or, you know, many of these Indian intellectuals from the 50s, 60s, 70s, many of them started off as Marxists. So Jayaprakash Narayan was the son of a small government official in the canals department in Bihar. And unlike, you know, the other Congress leadership, you know, who came from wealth and studied at Oxford and Cambridge, you know, with their parents' legal fortunes,
right.
He, you know, got the opportunity to study at Berkeley in the U.S. And, you know, paid for it by working as a farmer, by working as a mechanic, by, you know, doing odd jobs here and there, being part of the working class. And then when Berkeley's fees increased, he couldn't afford even that. He switched, moved to the University of Wisconsin. He was constantly on the move. And he was exposed to Marxism in the US. So not, you know, soft Fabian socialism in the UK.
Right.
You know, he, you know,
full-blown Marxism.
Life, yeah, full-blown Marxism. He experienced life as, you know, a proletarian
right.
in the Western world, in an industrial country, and came back. And there are others as well. Sitaram Goyal, who's now seen as like the godfather of the BJP or of, you know, Hindutva or the new idea of India. He was also a Marxist. You had people like M.N. Roy, S.A. Dange, you know, who founded the Communist Party of India. They were inspired initially by Savarkar. So there was a lot of overlap, you know, between Indian intellectuals who were trying to create their own ideologies. And so Jayaprakash Narayan came back to India. He got involved with the Bhudan movement of Acharya Vinoba Bhave, so giving land to the landless, you know, as a way of giving people the tools they needed to reclaim dignity, to lift them, lift themselves up out of poverty. And he began theorizing as well. He moved a bit away from Marxism and created, you know, a form of indigenous socialism, you know, based on Gandhian principles, or based on, you know, village life, and proposed a new structure for India. So rather than the state and center relationship, well, village democracy, and then, you know, district democracy, then state, then the federal government. And as the frustrations grew among the public, you know, especially in the 70s, you remember that in the 70s, one of the iconic cultural products of the 70s was Amitabh Bachchan's films as The Angry Young Man.
Right.
The Angry Young Man is also a reflection of society in the 70s. You've seen those films.
Mm-hmm.
What did it show? It showed
frustration.
You know, a working class guy where, you know, everything was against him. The system was against him. You know, the only rich people were smugglers. The police were corrupt. The government
right.
didn't care because they had their hands in everyone's pockets. And then, you know, he rises up and, you know, gives voice to the masses. That's exactly the kind of sentiment that was tapped into these anti-Congress movements. And that's what led to the Sampurna Kranti Andolan. So he called for a total revolution. He's and asked for it to be led by the youth, that young people should go on strike from schools and universities. They should commit themselves to volunteer work, to create, you know, parallel structures that actually, you know, benefited people's lives and communities. And of course, the state reacted the only way it knows how, by shooting them. And this, you know, is, you know, just proof. It validated everything that was being said. That, you know, how is this different from British colonialism?
Right.
The only difference is that the person who gave the order, instead of being a General Dyer, is an Indira Gandhi, or, you know, her CM of Bihar, Abdul Ghaffur. And this created, you know, a lot of panic in the ranks. And around the same time, you had the court verdict, Raj Narayan versus Indira Gandhi, where they found that she had used state machinery to get elected in 1971, which disqualified her from parliament and the prime ministership. And that's when emergency was proclaimed.
Oh, well,
so she claimed because of internal and external disturbances that the foreign hand, the CIA, is funding Jayaprakash and funding Morarji Desai, funding George Fernandez, the trade unionist, and Amnesty International, and Atal Bihari Vajpayee, sent them all to jail. Jayaprakash was treated so badly in jail that he never recovered. He, you know, his kidneys failed in jail. He was on dialysis for the rest of his life. He was unable to join the government once emergency ended in 77. You know, he you know, offered advice, you know, to Morarji Desai or to George Fernandez and the like, but he was essentially crippled after. And this, you know, was a period of great hope, that the first non-Congress government at the federal level, you know, with this revolutionary plan to, you know, give India back to the masses, to reform the constitution, to create, you know, new laws, to, you know, this was also a period of self-reliance, you know, when George Fernandez kicked out IBM and Coca-Cola,
right,
and, you know, built up indigenous, you know, the IT sector in India, if it exists, it exists because IBM was kicked out by George Fernandez for selling outdated machinery at a high price. And basically, you know, it was a colonial, neo-colonial form of doing business.
Right.
And it was a period of great transformation, but it ended very soon. And they never got a majority in the Rajya Sabha to make fundamental changes to the constitution, or even reverse the constitution to the way it was before
the emergency. What does it mean, though? Sorry, please finish.
And it's just that, yeah, after that, so after they fell in 1980, almost every major leader that we've come to associate with modern, you know, modern India in the last few decades has arisen from the Janata Party across a wide range of spectra. So even, you know, non-conventional choices. So, you know, you have, you know, these caste leaders in UP and Bihar. So, for example, Ram Vilas Paswan or Lalu Prasad Yadav, they started off there. You even have Subramaniam Swamy, who started off in the Janata Party. You have Arun Jaitley, who came from the Janata Party. So a very wide mix. You know, later on they were, you know,
shuffling
opposed
between
to each other.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, and shuffling between each other. But a lot of what we see today, modern politics is defined by, you know, what was essentially the second independence movement of India in 1977.
But I'm still, like, you know, what the fascinating part is, what you mentioned, is that Jayaprakash is not a name, it's a set of ideals. What are those ideals? What is that commitment to?
So the, there's a famous speech, you know, when Atal Bihari Vajpayee left the Janata Party, when the Janata Party collapsed, in fact, and splintered into various
factions,
new parties.
Right.
Yes. In 1980, the BJP was born, and Atal Bihari Vajpayee gave a speech in which he said, "Janata Party toot gayi, lekin hum Jay Prakash ke sapno ko tootne nahi denge. Jay Prakash kisi vyakti ka naam nahi. Jay Prakash kuch adarshon ka naam hai, kuch mulyon ka naam hai." And that was about rejecting, you know, foreign ideologies and their agents, and about creating, you know, an indigenous narrative, giving self-respect to, you know, our citizens, not treating citizens as subjects, you know, as these savage natives who need to be civilized, who, you know, need this carrot and stick state that rewards them for good behavior and punishes them for bad behavior. But a state is made up of its citizens. The citizens have a right to demand and get a state that works for them.
Hmm.
A state which reflects their values.
Hmm.
It's not the responsibility of the people to live up to the values that a bunch of elites set up for them, but rather to have a fully decolonized state, a country that is actually by the people, for the people, of the people.
Right. I think I'll save what that looks like for another time. I think I at least have 1 hour worth more questions, and I don't even mean that as an exaggeration. I have my mind going in all directions right now, but this has been fantastic. Did you have
likewise.
Fun?
Oh, yes, so much.
Thank you.
And,
go ahead.
Yeah, and with the directions it takes, I don't have any prescriptions myself either. It would be exciting to see how the people take it forward, because at the end of the day, if we are to be a true democracy, if we are to have a country whose state institutions, whose values are reflections of the people, then it's completely in the hands of the people to take it in the direction they want and in the manner that they want to. So it's going to be an exciting couple of decades ahead.
Right. For sure. For sure. Thank you so much, Richard. This has been absolutely fantastic.